We gather this hour as people of faith with joys and sorrows, gifts and needs. We light this beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning in celebration of the life we share together. I would like to read just a few brief excerpts from a book titled Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun by Jeffrey Canada. He writes, America has long had a love affair with violence and guns. It's our history. We teach it to all of our young. The Revolution, the Taming of the West, the Civil War, the World Wars, and on and on. Guns, justice, righteousness, freedom, liberty, all tied to violence. Even when we try to teach about nonviolence, we have to use the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., killed by the violent. Some may think that this violence is new, but it's not. Violence has always been around. The nature of the violent act has changed from fist, stick, knife, to the gun. As an adult, I have heard many times, Canada says, the debate about whether violence is part of the human makeup or a learned behavior. There is no way, he says, that I can buy the theory that humans have some genetic predisposition to violence. While it can be argued that America has always been a violent nation, Americans have been slaughtering one another at record numbers over the past decade and a half in what can only be called America's secret war against itself. If there is a greater threat to the internal security of this country than the current violence, I don't know what it is, Canada says. The fact of the matter seems quite simple to me. Either we address the murder and mayhem in our country, or we simply won't be able to continue to have the kind of democratic society that we as Americans cherish. Violence is not a problem of the inner cities or of the minorities in this country. This is a national crisis, and the nation must mobilize differently if we are to solve it. The impact and fear of violence has overrun the boundaries of our ghettos and has both its hands firmly around the neck of our whole country. And while you may not yet have been visited by the specter of death and fear of this new national cancer, just give it time. Sooner or later, unless we act, you will. We all will. Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun was published in 1995. When I was in seminary 18 years ago. The subtitle of Canada's book is A Personal History of Violence. It was published by Beacon Press under the auspices of our Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. We were very proud of our connection with Canada, and the book was for a while a must-read item. Then I forgot about it. Not long after December 14th and the killings in Newtown, Connecticut, I remembered that book, and I knew that before I could talk to you about the culture of violence in which we live, I would have to reread it. I hope that you will read it. It's a short book. It's a depressing book in so many ways, but also a hopeful one. it could change your life, or at least energize you enough to convince you that you can do something about changing the culture. While Canada's emphasis is on the violence in our inner cities and the terror that so many children experience in those places on a daily basis, what he has to say is applicable to the United States as a whole. And if we are going to walk the talk of our Unitarian Universalist beliefs, then we must believe that what happens to the people in the ghettos matters. I am talking particularly, or thinking particularly, of our first and seventh principles, which you will find at the beginning of the hymnal, right before the first hymn that we sang this morning. And most of you will know what the first and seventh principles are. Our first one says that we will affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And the seventh one says that we will affirm and promote respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. I wish that I could stand up here and tell you that all will be well, that you will be safe from senseless acts of violence, and I could kind of see that hope in some of your eyes at the program committee. We'd say, oh, Sandy can do a service on violence. They don't have magic answers. I wish that I could at least reassure you that when you encounter people like Eduardo in the story For All Ages, it will be a benign encounter, something unexpected, something that doesn't require much effort on your part will happen. And what could have been a violent situation will magically, miraculously, be transformed into nonviolence. There is more to Eduardo's story than that. For one thing, Eduardo, like all of us, has the potential to be good or bad. You might have noticed that Eduardo became more and more difficult when the adults in his life told him that he was messy or cruel or nasty. I believe that is known as negative reinforcement. But when he got positive reinforcement, even though he got it for the wrong reasons, his behavior improved. His culture, his frame of reference, changed, shifted. So even though I am going to get into some gloom and doom talk right now, please remember that I believe there is hope for us humans. I believe that we can change our culture. Last Sunday, our speaker talked about how media violence affects children. It was a good service, but it only addressed a tiny part of the problem of violence in our culture. Now, of course, she only had a little bit of time, and that was what we asked her to do. The problem is so complex. There is no one quick fix. There are many things that will have to happen and problems that will have to be solved before we can even start the journey from being a culture of violence to be one of nonviolence. And too many guns is one of the biggest obstacles in our path. Perhaps a case can be made that the human race would not have survived for this long, if it had never resorted to violence. Now, though, I believe, and this is not only my belief, that the opposite is true, that reptilian part of our brain that tells us to fight or flee, but not to confront problems usually, that reptilian part of our brain keeps getting in the way when we are trying to solve our major problems. If we can't recognize when reptilian brain is getting in the way, if we can't change the conversation about violence, if we can't change the way we think about violence, I'm afraid that there might not be much hope for humanity. That may sound terribly harsh. I'm not sure I actually believe those words that I just said. I don't want to believe them. Yet violence is so ingrained in our culture, it's difficult not to be discouraged. All of us grew up surrounded by and immersed in violence to varying degrees. I played cowboys and Indians, and I was always a cowboy, never a cowgirl. Girls were weak, sissies. I was certainly not an Indian because they always lost. I bullied one of my cousins, something that greatly embarrasses me to this day, though she claims not to remember it. In junior and senior high school, especially junior high school, I would never wear green and yellow, and especially not on Thursdays, because someone might think I was a fairy. I had no idea what a fairy was, but I knew it wasn't something I wanted to be. Talk about bullying. My father bullied me. I did not realize that until a few years ago, 2004, when I was with him at the 60th anniversary of D-Day. He's a D-Day veteran. We were revisiting places in England and France, and places where he had been during the war, and we were on a trip to Stonehenge, which, whoa, blew me away. I'm not very good with time, and my father has always picked on me about, had always picked on me about that. So I got back to the small van where we were together, and we were traveling with 18 to 20 people maybe, veterans, and they're sometimes their children, sometimes partners. And I got on the bus, and of course my dad was already there, and I was 2 or 3 minutes late, and he started tapping the watch and making disparaging remarks, and I, you know, just, and a woman behind me, my father's age, one I'd really gotten to like and know on this trip, later said to me, "Has he always bullied you that way?" And something clicked. That's what it was, bullying. And there was no reason to, not call him on that by the time I got into my 50s. Is it any wonder that as adults we try to ignore the violence happening all around us? It is painful and difficult to confront violence, whether we are the perpetrators or the recipients. We go to great lengths to build elaborate walls, literally and figuratively, around our lives to shut out the violence. We live in fear of so many things. And of course, this has all been ratcheted way up by 9/11. We live in fear, but we only increase our fears by our actions. We circle the wagons rather than opening up the space to allow more people into the circle. We respond to violence in strange ways. Here are three ways that I have observed. We glorify it, we condone it, we condemn it. There are any number of ways we glorify violence. Owning guns is one of those ways. And I'm not going to say much about guns right now, this morning. There's not enough time, and I would get really angry. But I also suspect that most of us are in agreement about the necessity of reducing the number of guns in this country. We also glorify violence in movies, music, television, video games. I have a confession to make. I go to Quentin Tarantino movies. And I like them. Well, like isn't the correct word. But I am fascinated by his movies. Yes, I saw Django Unchained. Anybody else see it? Anybody admit to it? The D is silent. You'll get it. The D is silent. I thought it was an excellent movie. And yes, there's plenty of obvious, overt violence in it. In fact, so much so that I think it becomes a caricature of itself. lots of people get shot, and there are body parts and blood and gore flying all around, and people die in other equally gory ways. But there is, believe it or not, a lot of humor in this movie. However, the real violence in Django Unchained is not the shooting and gory deaths. The real violence in the movie is not the physical violence. Some of the real violence doesn't even happen on screen. It is the violence that occurs when people are treated as subhuman, as less than, because of the color of their skin. The real violence is what happened to the people in this movie psychologically and emotionally and socially to not only the bad people in the movie, but to good, gentle people when they are bullied, mistreated, bought, and sold. Okay, hang on to your seats now. We glorify violence in this country every time a football game is played. Unfortunately, we call it football. I am not anti-sports. Some of you know I'm a jock or a jockette, or I don't know what the term is. I love sports. That is, sports that don't routinely involve throwing somebody on the ground, doing serious bodily harm, and acting tough. In my humble opinion, football reinforces everything that helps maintain our culture of violence. Football tells young people that it is okay to hit as hard as you can, to cause injuries to others, to intentionally mistreat your own body and the bodies of others. May you all enjoy the Super Bowl. In addition to glorifying violence, we condone it all the time, which is not the same thing as glorifying it. We condone violence every time we bully other people, and bullying can be a subtle thing, and we're all guilty of it. I suspect that most of us are guilty of bullying more than we realize, because it happens when, without thinking, through our language and our need to be in control, we fail to take into consideration how our words might affect others. We disrespect people all the time. We condone violence by our silence in the face of violence that is invisible to us. Violence that is invisible can include drone strikes, poverty, bullying, domestic violence, elder abuse, the state of our inner cities, drug use, homelessness, all invisible to most of us most of the time. That is, until the invisible becomes visible, as it did this past week right here in our building when Prairie became a homeless shelter for 2 nights. In that moment, in those 2 nights, despite all the reasons not to, Prairie opted for a culture of non-violence. Time stopped. There were lots of reasons why we should not have offered our space for people who had nowhere else to go in sub-zero weather. There were plenty of concerns, rightly so, I might add, especially in hindsight, about the rashness of what we did and the possible consequences, but just for that instance, we chose to be a model of what a culture of kindness, a culture of gentleness might be. Despite all the walls between us and them, despite legitimate, practical concerns about what could have happened, just for that moment, we became a culture of nonviolence. It was a beautiful thing. It was a scary thing. I was definitely out of my comfort zone when I spent a few hours here on Tuesday afternoon and evening. But I learned so much. I have been reflecting for days on a conversation that I had with another volunteer, someone outside of Prairie, who said to me that as far as treating the homeless as full human beings is concerned, most of us are only at about the same place where many people were when Selma, occurred during the civil rights era. It was a scary thing that happened here last Monday and Tuesday, and it was a beautiful thing. Thank you, all of you who made it happen. The third way that we respond to violence is by condemning it, ranting against it, and then by doing nothing to change the culture. Because we condemn violence with an attitude of resignation and fatalism, the "there is nothing we can do about it" syndrome. Is it possible then to respond to violence in a different way? With a problem this complex, how can we ever hope to change the culture? First and foremost, we have to change the way we think. And before you just let that float out, that's impossible. It's not only possible, but there are many examples throughout history of people changing the way they think. Change the way we think about violence and the conversations about violence change and become more productive. Culture matters and culture can be changed. Education and knowledge are crucial components of cultural change. In a recent editorial, Washington Post columnist Kathleen Parker wrote about the importance of culture and lamented the fact that knowledge seems to matter less and less in the United States of the 21st century. She was particularly incensed with so-called reality TV. As she put it, reality, after all, is what civilization attempts to mitigate. After being appalled when running into a reality show called Honey Boo Boo, while channel surfing and, quote, in urgent need of purification, unquote, she stumbled onto a documentary about ancient Egypt. Must have been on PBS or the History Channel. Ancient Egypt and Alexander the Great's time. Alexander the Great understood the importance of knowledge in shaping a kinder, gentler culture. According to Parker, in the city of Alexandria, outdoor classrooms were as ubiquitous as Starbucks today. That doesn't mean that there wasn't any violence. There was plenty. In the 4th century in the city of Alexandria, Christian mobs dragged a beautiful and brilliant woman named Hypatia, who was a philosopher, mathematician, astronomer, and teacher. They dragged her from her carriage, and then they stripped, flayed, and chopped her into pieces before burning her body parts on a pyre. It didn't help her cause that she was a confessed pagan. Plus, she seemed to be a tad too smart, Parker writes, for the divinely inspired man who murdered her. But despite incidents like this, the trajectory of the culture of Egypt at that time was aimed towards nonviolence and away from violence. It would be interesting to have a discussion about whether that's what India is trying to do right now. Which brings me back to Jeffrey Canada's book. Not all was lovelier in other times, and all is far from lovely in our times. Lest you think that something published in 1995 isn't relative in 2013, read a paper from any city in this country. I read the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel almost every day. On January 16, 2013, columnist James E. Causey wrote this. There are zip codes in Milwaukee where a child has a greater chance of being incarcerated or killed than graduating from high school. You see why I warned you at the beginning that I was going to get into gloom and doom talk? I am sickened and saddened by the idea that assault weapons probably won't be banned. And I am really angry about the plight of our inner cities and the desperation of the children who live there. Is there any way I can use this anger constructively and not feel so depressed about the culture of violence in which we live? What would a culture of nonviolence look like, I wondered. Well, here are some of the items on my list of how we might begin to move from a violent culture to a gentler, kinder, mostly nonviolent one. These are in no particular order. stop putting so many people in prison, have more restorative justice programs and more drug courts. Launch a plan similar to the Marshall Plan. If you don't know what that was, come and see me later. To transform the inner cities the way we transformed Germany after World War II. Stop playing football. Sorry, had to say that. Switch from a consumer-oriented economy to a service-oriented one. Listen to what the homeless have to say about homelessness. Acknowledge the fact that they are full human beings. Use the F word less frequently. Turn off outside lights and things that make noise, shut them down so that children can experience the peace of nature once in a while. Have mandatory classes in schools using material from Jeffrey Canada, Marion Wright Edelman, and others who really understand what violence is doing to this country because they live with it daily. Expand the definition of bullying. I could go on, but you get the idea. In the meantime, since probably none of the things on my wish list are going to happen anytime soon, how about considering a prairie project that would work on nonviolence? We could learn how to model nonviolence. We could find out more about the Wisconsin anti-violence effort, which I didn't, capitals, Wisconsin anti-violence effort, which I did not realize even existed until a few days ago. We could explore possibilities of working with Edelman's Children's Defense Fund or Jeffrey Canada's Beacon Schools project. We can change the culture. We can change the conversation about violence. We can change the way we think about violence. We can start by dismantling the walls that keep us from doing these things. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard. The path is never clear, and the stakes are very high. Take courage. For deep down, there is another truth. You are not alone. So turn to your neighbor and realize that you're not alone. Drink coffee or whatever.